proves their justification of dehumanizing migrants to justify their violence.
And Montana, we only have about a minute left, but if you could talk about this whole issue of them raiding you just after you released a report similar to what happened back in 2017 when a raid happened after you released the report.
Yeah, so in 2017, we released the Disappear Part 2, and about 4 hours later, Dr. Scott Warren was apprehended. This time, this was less than 24 hours, so we released this report, or these documents, on Wednesday at about 11 a.m., and the first time they entered camp without a warrant was on Thursday around 8 or 9 a.m. So less than 24 hours later, they started their intimidation tactics and surveillance.
And this was BORTAC, the same unit, the same group that has been going after Black Lives Matter in places like Portland, Oregon? We have 5 seconds.
Yes, it was BORTAC.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Montana Thames, for joining us, humanitarian aid worker with No More Deaths. And we'll continue to show what happens there. And people can go to our website at democracynow.org to get our interviews with Scott Warren after he was arrested. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Libby Rainey, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Carla Wills, Tammy Wernoff, Trina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe, save lives, wear a mask.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
This is KBOO Portland. It's 8 a.m. on Tuesday. Time for Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show with your hosts, Abe Proctor and Joe Uris. Stay tuned to your community connection.
Hey, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
It's weird out there.
It is.
It is. Yes. I need to tell people this is KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland, Oregon. This is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show. That's Abe Proctor. I'm Joe Uris. The number to call, and you can call, is 231-8187. Abe, what are we going to be talking about?
Well, we got a couple things on plate today, Joe, one of which is the changing protest situation here in Portland now that the feds have withdrawn, or at least committed to withdraw. It's not entirely clear what's going on there, but we'll get to that.
I heard they were hiding behind windows.
Hiding behind windows. It's entirely possible, yeah. So we're going to talk about that. But first, I want to talk about this bombshell story that was released by Vanity Fair last week that details the process by which Jared Kushner, the wonder kid at the White House, assembled and then led his crack team of experts to develop a comprehensive nationwide testing system for COVID-19.
Did it work?
No. No.
We're laughing. Is it terrible?
Yeah. It didn't. And I mentioned the word bombshell because there was at least one item, which we'll get to here very shortly, that confirmed something a lot of people had suspected for quite some time. It was one of those things in the Trump era that you kind of knew was going on, but to see it actually confirmed in print was a bit on the shocking side. So let me just walk people through this article, because it's a really nice piece of writing, and it charts a fascinating story. So Jared Kushner was put in charge of the testing and contact tracing.
Jared Kushner, the guy whose father is in the joint and is married to the president's daughter?
That's the guy, yes. The perfect choice to organize a nationwide COVID-19 testing program.
Yeah, he's got a lot of experience in medical issues.
He does. Yeah, exactly. So this Jared was given this job way back around the beginning of March, the end of February, when we were just starting to get an idea of how bad a problem this was going to be. So Kushner was put in charge of this effort, procuring testing kits, procuring personal protective equipment, and establishing a contact tracing regimen and a testing regimen. Were all under his purview, as the head of this task force in the White House. So during March and April, Kushner assembled this this handpicked team, mostly young business associates and friends of his, including a former college roommate. Now, to their credit, they did enlist several experts from the world of diagnostics and disease testing. So they did have some expert opinions informing their effort. But top to bottom, this was not a group of seasoned bureaucrats used to working within the sphere of the federal government and its extensive system of procurement and contracts and distribution. You know, all of the things that make it one of the few entities capable of exercising a logistical effort of this scale, right?
Right.
Right. Of all of the bodies out there that could put together a comprehensive testing and tracing regimen, really the federal government is at the top of the list in terms of the resources, the personnel, and the existing infrastructure, right?
Right. Right. No, so, really. That's one of the few things they can do.
Yes. Jared's team took advantage of none of these. They were working essentially in a bubble. They were not sharing information or coordinating with any of the parallel efforts going on within the federal government, happening in places where you'd think they would, like the Department of Health and Human Services, for example.
Yeah.
But Jared's team soldiered on, setting up their plan, getting ready to run it out and put it into practice towards the end of March. Now, the parallel development that was happening at this time was that Trump himself was coming around to the position, I think one that he has nursed in his hard little heart from the very beginning of this, which was, this is no big deal, this is all gonna go away. It's not worth establishing a nationwide testing and tracking system, because it's gonna make him look really bad. It's gonna reveal the true scope of the problem, and he's been shying away from that since the very beginning.
Well, we all know, more testing, the more more people who have the virus.
Yes, indeed. So I should mention that the Vanity Fair source, one of the sources cited by Vanity Fair, is a healthcare expert who worked closely with Jared Kushner's group in the White House and was advising them on how to proceed. So, and therefore was privy to a great deal of the planning and organization that was going on. So unfortunately, the plan that Jared and his team got into place wasn't all that bad. You know, it wasn't perfect. It was certainly flawed, but in the context of the political climate and the social climate at the time, would have at least been a place to start, right? A plan from which to work as we scrambled to get this nationwide system in place. So, despite his lack of expertise and his cohort's lack of expertise, Jared and company actually managed to come up with something that wasn't very good, but at least was passable. And then right around the beginning of April, the fateful decision was made in the White House to not go forward with the plan. And this is where, this is because Trump had decided it wasn't worth it. And the decision was made, and this is where this article gets chilling, and this is what's reported by the public health contact within Kushner's group. They decided not to do it. They decided that this was going to fall hardest upon the blue states. So they were going to abandon this plan, let the governors take care of everything, and this was essentially the Trump administration washing its hands of the whole COVID-19.
Wait a minute. They were going to not help the Democratic states?
That's exactly right. Yeah.
And they... go on.
Yeah. I mean, this
is amazing.
Yes, but this was something that observers at the time, ourselves included, noted when we were watching what was happening. We were saying things like, it appears that Trump is just stepping away from this. It appears as though he's just letting it devolve onto the governors. And that's, in fact, exactly what was going on. But this article in Vanity Fair confirms that that was, in fact, the case, and lays out in excruciating detail how they made this decision to essentially abandon the American people to the wilds of this pandemic. So, yeah, I really
die in case people on the air couldn't hear me.
Yeah, indeed. And here's the quote. Most troubling of all, perhaps, was a sentiment the expert said a member of Kushner's team expressed. Now, this is the public health expert who was in consultation with Kushner's group. And here is the sentiment that Kushner's team expressed, that because the virus had hit blue states hardest, a national plan was unnecessary and would not make sense politically. Quote, the political folks believed that because it was going to be relegated to Democratic states, that they could blame those governors, and that would be an effective political strategy, said the expert.
Wait, they were going to let people die so that Trump could get an elected president?
That is exactly correct, Joe.
The
article, it is disgusting. The article is called How Jared Kushner's Secret Testing Plan Went Poof into Thin Air. It's in the most recent edition of Vanity Fair, and I encourage everybody to read it. It's, as I mentioned, it's both chilling, and it also confirms what observers had believed for a long time about the situation. Now, there's another kind of interesting parallel story inside here, which is that Kushner, while placed in charge of the testing team, was also, to a limited extent, placed in charge of procurement. So I want everybody to cast their minds way back early in the pandemic. I know it seems like decades and decades ago, but there was this period of time when there was an acute shortage of personal protective gear for frontline healthcare workers, mostly N95 filtration masks, also things like ventilators, gowns, goggles. Everybody remembers that, right? Everybody remembers
that. That was the idea to help people survive this thing.
Oh, right. Yeah. And we all remember seeing the news stories, like these nurses saying, I've just been washing out this mask. I've used the same mask for 5 shifts in a row. You remember all that?
Oh, I do.
Oh, yes. So meanwhile, Jared is running around striking deals essentially off the books to procure quantities of personal protective equipment. Only this is just Jared Kushner and his friends working. There's a whole established federal system of procurement, as I mentioned earlier, of contracting, of distribution. So Vanity Fair acquired an invoice from one of these shady companies who was going to procure test kits in this case, and they provide a photograph of the invoice. And it's an invoice for a lot of money, and the customer that's listed there is simply listed as WH for White House. So this was somebody in the White House finagled this shady order for lots and lots of test kits, which proved to be faulty in the end, and they did it illegally without using any of the government's established contract officers or procurement processes. So, I mean, it's just a picture of ineptitude, of political blindness, and of the willful disregard for the health and safety of the lives of the American people.
You forgot one thing. Greed.
What's that?
Greed.
Oh, yeah. That's absolutely true. So, a really nice piece of reporting from Vanity Fair. And, I think one that will help form the annals of this age once all of these fools are out of office. Anything you want to add to that, Joe?
Well, there is. I want to know why it is that the media, the various elements of the media from the right to the left, are so passively descriptive and fail to really nail this sort of thing down adequately, because all of us are at risk in this real pandemic. The pandemic is not a political issue. The pandemic is a healthcare issue for the entire nation, and because it really shuts down the economy, is leading directly to a depression as well as people dying.
Yeah, you're absolutely correct. It is leading directly to a depression. But to answer your question, why was the media so passively descriptive of all this? And why do they, in general, continue to be passively descriptive? I think the answer is twofold. First, that the media, by and large, the commercial media, is beholden to the corporations that own it. And they're unwilling, in the course of their reporting, to seriously challenge any of the prerogatives that directly affect the bottom line of their parent company. That's the first reason. And the second reason is sociological, and it results from the conditioning now over the period of decades to the fact that reporting, such as it exists in the United States, is not really reporting the facts and drawing an appropriate conclusion, but rather acting as a sort of glorified pool of stenographers who offer one side's opinion on a topic and then come back with the other side's opinion on a topic and don't ever really bother to establish who's right and who's wrong in terms of objective facts and in terms of the measurable world. So I think those are the answers to your question.
Well, in this case, it's murderous. I mean, it's not just a policy problem or somebody getting rich and other people not. This is killing children. This is killing particularly persons of color. This is killing anyone who comes in contact with the virus. It's murder.
Yeah, it is absolutely murder. And we know now that the explicit decision was made within the White House to abandon the nascent nationwide testing plan and let the governors handle it. And we all know how that has turned out.
Well, we've also heard Trump over and over again say, if you test too much, you'll get more people with the virus, so we don't want to test.
Yeah, he's continuing to say that. He just tweeted that again a few days ago.
The dude is psychopathic and dangerous and crazy and needs to be removed from office as soon as possible.
Yeah, see, the thing is, we already had a shot to remove him from office, and we didn't take it, did we?
Well, yeah, true.
He was impeached, and then he was tried in the Senate and acquitted.
Well, the Senate.
Yeah. Yeah, big broken system we got, Joe.
I think this is really the bottom line of all of this. We have, at this point in our history, no national health care plan, no real way of dealing with crises, and it is all broken, and it's starting, the broken pieces are starting to stab us in the belly.
Yeah, yeah. The most recent tally of new COVID-19 cases I saw was from a couple of days ago over the weekend, and it was nearly 50,000. It was 48,800 and something.
Yeah.
That's new cases in a single day here in the United States of America. We are not close to getting out of this pandemic. We are staring around the country I don't think we can go any other direction but in another extended lockdown of our economy and of our social body. That's what we're looking at, because we could not get our act together the first time. And I'm not confident that we'll be able to get our act together the second time.
Well, there are a lot of consequences to this, one of which is the children will be unable to go to school because it's too dangerous. And that's in a neighborhood, it's kind of like mine, where there's a lot of educated parents and so on. They can kind of do the schooling. But many people in the United States come out of a bad educational system themselves and will not be able to help their children, will not, in fact, have the tools they need, computers and so forth and so on. And there's no plan to deal with that, no national effort at all. And you have to contrast that with what's going on in Europe, where everything is as close to normal as you can have under these circumstances.
Yeah, the contrast really couldn't be any more stark. Every single other wealthy nation in the country has figured this out.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think we are going to be struggling under the fallout of this disaster for years and years to come in this country.
Well, there's two things. It must be made, three things, really. A delay in knowledge base of children and education. Number two, the economy falling apart. And number three, people dying.
Yeah, yeah. You mentioned the school situation. I am squarely in that boat. I have a son, just turned 7. He finished first grade this past spring. We did the last half here at home, his mom and I. Neither of us are trained educators. It was a struggle. It was nowhere near the level of engagement and the level of expertise, let's be honest, that he would have encountered in the classroom. His mom and I are smart people, but we are no substitute for an educator who is trained to deal with 6 and 7 year olds, you know, all day, every day. It just doesn't even come close. Not to mention all of the other reasons that kids need to be in school beyond mere education. They need to be there to learn how to be humans among other humans, right? This is how you learn to be a member of society. It's by socializing with other people your age in the young part of your life. I also have a daughter who's 3. We had to pull her out of preschool, and her preschool has subsequently closed its doors forever because of the pandemic. She is 3 years old. She is right in the middle of that wheelhouse where kids need to be in preschool. I mean, study after study shows these are the years where if you can get your kid into preschool, into some pre-K education, it's going to pay dividends the rest of your life. And she can't do it because our president can't get his act together with a damn nationwide testing program.
Well, he doesn't care. I mean, the most important thing about him is he doesn't even try. He just huffs and puffs and blows the world down.
Yeah, yeah, he does. But the point I'm making, you know, besides people dying from this disease, this horrible disease, you have kids who are going to miss out on this sweet spot in their education that they need for the rest of their lives. And my kid is one of them. It's just so frustrating, Joe.
Well, it's beyond frustrating. It's terrifying. We are going to move our position as a nation from an educated, caring nation into a situation of third world incompetence at the lead, because we have a leader who's psychotic.
Yeah, it's true. All right, we should mention 503-231-8187. Is the number to call to join this conversation. So that's on the table. The Vanity Fair article, the failure of our nation to look after the welfare of its citizens in this horrible time.
You know, one of the few bright spots in all of this is I am seeing some very good reporting in a variety of publications, the kinds of publications you wouldn't even expect, like Vanity Fair.
Right, exactly. So I want to leave... I'm sorry, go ahead.
I didn't say a word.
Oh, okay. Thought I heard something there. So that's on the table. The Vanity Fair article, the disaster, ongoing disaster of the pandemic. I would also like to bring into the conversation the changing protest situation here in Portland. We know that the tensions dramatically ratcheted down with the exit of federal troops, although both Trump and the Secretary of Homeland Security made some noise about the troops not really leaving until the violence ends. But there have not been nightly clashes with federal protesters downtown. There was a dust up over the weekend on the east side of the river with Portland police. It got a little bit violent, but along the continuum of violence that the city has seen in recent weeks, it really wasn't much. I guess some police officers knocking some protesters to the ground. And the police officers, of course, are barred from using tear gas or from targeting journalists or observers or using any of the nasty tactics that the feds so helpfully provided during their sojourn in Portland. So that is good. So we'd be very interested to hear this morning from people who are part of that protest movement daily and who are able to offer their observations and reflections on what's going on. I did happen to come across something rather interesting on the Twitter that I would like to share with our listeners right now. sometimes you go down on the Twitter, you can find some interesting things down the Twitter rabbit hole. This is from a young woman living in Lake Oswego. Here's the tweet. My younger sister painted a sign on the front window of our house to show our support of the Black Lives Matter movement and was sent this in the mail from one of our neighbors. The tweet adds, this is 100% on brand for Lake Oswego. So first of all, the sign that was painted in the window reads as follows. Silence supports police violence. That's what's painted in the window. So I'm going to read you now the letter that concerned Lake Oswego neighbors sent to the residents of this house with the sign in the window. Dear neighbor, we, your neighbors, appreciate that you have a strong political and social justice viewpoint and wish to communicate that to others via your window sign. The First Amendment gives you that right. We believe you've made your point. As tensions rise in our city, home is the safe and quiet place we wanted to return to after being at work. We want to come home to a beautiful street where neighbors care and support one another. We have three homes on our street that are trying to sell for the best price possible. Your sign is driving down interest to live on this street. Hence, our property values suffer, including yours. We feel you've made your statement and respectfully request you remove it and save your political viewpoint for inside your home. Homes are not made to be billboards for our opinions. They are a place for families to rest, enjoy life, and feel safe. Thank you in advance for caring enough about the people you live side by side with, especially those with different viewpoints, by removing your sign. Find your neighbors.
You know, that is so bizarre. That is so ugly. I can remember a time years ago when the joke in Portland was, like, no Negro.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. And what was interesting is that I scrolled down. I wanted to read the replies to this tweet. So I scrolled down the thread, and other people posted other letters that they got from their neighbors here in Portland. So it was just not this isolated incident like Oswego. It's happening, at least in some other neighborhoods. Here's a letter that somebody wrote to a house in Selwood. Dear neighbor, I wanted to write, in case you are unaware, how radical the organization Black Lives Matters is. Surely there are better signs or ways to show your support for the core belief we all have, that people should be judged by the content of their character and not the color of their skin. That's a complete misreading of what Black Lives Matter is about, but I digress. The letter continues. Black Lives Matter supports the following, and you can look this up on their website. Abolishing most prisons. No borders. Abolishing police. Against capitalism generally. Again, we support equal justice under the law in this neighborhood, but my hope is that you will consider showing it in a way that does not support extremely radical organizations. Either way, I wanted to ensure you are aware of BLM's history and what you are supporting by having their sign up in your yard. Please consider another option if you feel appropriate.
What would be another option, just out of curiosity?
No, the other option is shut up. Stuff that makes us uncomfortable.
I think you're
That's
right.
That's what that means. Yeah. I mean, this is Portland, right? So all these letters are exceedingly polite, but they're essentially saying, shut up and keep this to yourself because it makes us feel uncomfortable. And to those people, I just have to say, well, I'm sorry that you feel uncomfortable, but the rights and physical safety of people of color are more important than your feelings. So to those people who are flying signs in their homes or placing signs on their windows, you keep right on doing it.
Well, I absolutely agree with that. And I think that one of the most disgusting things is the state of denial that so many middle class and upper class white people are exhibiting in the face of reality of the whole history of persons of color and Mexican Americans and so forth. And the fact that I shouldn't say nobody, but so many people don't want to admit the situation. I grew up in Southern California. I remember having friends who were the children of braceros. I remember the importance of Mexican American workers during World War II.
Indeed. We've got Mike on the line. Should we go to the phones? Good morning, Mike.
Good morning. Thank you.
What's on your mind?
Appreciate your description of the genocide and eugenics that's going on policy-wise right now. And I just really want to add the medical community to these horrifying policies that are hurting us so badly. Through all these doctors, these prominent doctors that Fauci and all these voices, these health people never mention health. So they just delete and just don't talk about staying healthy for the virus. And we have no concerted societal or national effort to promote health whatsoever during a pandemic. And that just boggles my mind. And I just don't understand. In other eras, we promote health in this country and we've stopped doing it.
Well, there's one comment I do have that's really relevant. If we had, like most Western countries, including, by the way, very strongly capitalist countries, like most of Scandinavia, most of Central Europe, we would have a whole national health care system. I mean, that means a system. We don't have that. We have an entrepreneurial system of health care where you have to pay for insurance. If you don't pay for insurance, you have to pay even more for the doctors. The doctors themselves are dependent on the money that comes in. It's a whole system based on capitalism, not on the best service, best practice for everybody.
That's right, and that system not only keeps us from treating sick people, but it also keeps us from promoting health. It's just a barrier to health promotion.
Yeah, I would agree.
In a pandemic.
Indeed. Well, listen, thank you very much for the call. Appreciate it. All right, 503-231-8187 is the number to call to take part in this conversation. Tyler writes in to the Facebook page, facebook.com/AveandJoe. He says, there was an article on CNN about how suburban white people are actually a problem when it comes to Black Lives Matter. They, the white folk, want things to improve, but seem to draw a line when it comes to adjusting school boundaries. I've witnessed this in my district. The letter you read illustrates this point. You know, I think that's absolutely true. And I think that that phenomenon is especially visible in a mostly white, mostly liberal metropolitan area like Portland, where you might have well-to-do white people who, you know, in the abstract, support the goals of Black Lives Matter, but they don't actually want to see any substantive changes take place in their lives or in their community. It's a real problem, and I think it's something that we're going to have to figure out a way to overcome.
I agree with you. I mean, I think that there's, because of the very real subconscious, I'll even say, guilt of most white people, and because the whole idea of the privilege of whiteness is a way to distinguish oneself from the rest of the community, persons of color, the effect of this is very destructive and essentially has pushed forward things like redlining and things like school district outlines and all sorts of things which put persons of color and persons of Hispanic origin at incredible disadvantage.
Yes, this is true. And I would say amongst those phenomena you're describing is the willingness of many middle-class white people to ignore the brutality that the police inflict on communities of color, because they feel that that is being done to protect the safety of their own communities, which is a false perception from the very start. Yeah. So you're right. You're right, Joe. Mark writes in to the Facebook page, Joe, we have never lived in a caring nation, especially the past 40 years. From healthcare to housing to education, we are the meanest, least caring country in the Western world. How would you respond to that, Joe?
Well, I wish I could disagree with it. I can't. I mean, it's very disturbing. And I speak, having lived quite a long life and having seen how things are made to work. I've seen it in rural America, where I lived for a long time. I see it in the urban centers as well. And I see that we are a nation that in most structural ways encourage racism, sexism, and so on. And it's really, really devastating, and now with a pandemic when we all need to come together and work together and where our economy is in danger, we can realize what we are doing to ourselves, and hopefully we can learn something. But with the current administration, with the current biases, with the all kinds of defensiveness, that doesn't necessarily happen. It just doesn't happen.
All right, let's go back to the phones. Robbie, good morning.
Yeah, good morning. I just wanted to say a couple things. When you brought up that the system is really broken, we really need to look at this a lot differently, because the system is not broken. The system is fixed. This is doing exactly what the system is intended to do. It's intended to protect the rich white owners, landowners. It's doing exactly as it's told. That's why we don't have democracy. That's why the Democrats rigged another election and nobody seems to care. And also, I wanted to say oppression. If there's this really great thing, the white liberals that are ruining what I call, you know, the movement here, these are the ones that are policing people. These are the people that go in through, you know, like when I hear a white rich person, a liberal who's supportive of BLM, but then gets turned away or turned off by whatever's happening on the street, which, you know, I'll give you, it's messy. It's you know, you can't commit violence against property damage. But let me just say this here really quick. The root cause of every riot is some kind of oppression. If you want to end the riots, you have to end the oppression. If you want to end a riot without ending its root cause, you're just trying to silence and, you know, prevent. You're supporting the agenda. And so with that, there's also one other thing that I want to keep in mind with people here, because we think that, you know, riding with Biden's going to save us. Donald Trump is not the root cause of this. I've been protesting since Obama, when Joe Biden was, you know, in his administration and the first Black Lives Matter came out. So I really just want to stress that, you know, if we just think that we can elect Joe Biden, that all these problems are going to go away, they're not. Which is what I'll finish my last point with this, if you don't mind. It's really cool, but basically, I think it speaks volumes to what's happening here when we vote for the lesser of two evils. It says the Democrats were liberal, but the Republicans were conservative. So we voted Democrat, then the Democrats became conservative, but the Republicans became neoliberal. So we voted Democrat. Then the Democrats became neoliberal, but the Republicans were neo-fascist. So we voted Democrat. Then the Democrats became neo-fascist, but the Republicans were outright fascist. So we voted Democrat. We forgot our principles and voted for the lesser of evil all time. And this is what has gotten us by voting for the lesser of evil, two evils.
Well, I do want to comment on that. I think you're making, first of all, you're valid in your points. Unfortunately, the choices we practically have are very limited. And I think if Trump gets to stick around for another 4 years, it won't be theoretical fascism. There won't be mild fascism. It'll be cold, hard, ugly, Nazi-style fascism. And I'm very, very frightened of that. So I kind of agree with you, and I have to kind of disagree with you. And
yeah, you're
I understand
missing
where you're coming
though.
From, and in many ways you're correct. But I think the reality of the times, unfortunately, and this has often happened, force us into this kind of compromise that you're decrying. So it's ironic,
that's what
and it's not wrong, but it's very dangerous. Are you there?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're missing my point, is that this is a part of a plan. When you look at this, like, I'm about to lay some facts on you, and I don't want you to think that I'm crazy, but Bill Clinton literally called up Donald Trump and told him to run in 2015 when he decided to. I don't know if you guys are aware of this, but it's in a Washington Post article with multiple people confirming that it happened. So Bill Clinton called and told Donald Trump to run. They both...
Yeah, well, So what? I don't understand.
Hold on.
I don't understand where
hold
you're
on,
going with
on. It. So, okay, so then you're both aware. Here's the funny thing is Democrats and Republicans both agree whenever I bring this fact up that they say, oh, well, Bill Clinton and the Clintons thought that they would be easier to run against Donald Trump. That doesn't change the fact that we actually had Bill Clinton call up Donald Trump, said that he was striking a chord with angry conservatives, and he should play a larger role in this. So I think what we're doing is we're focused on Trump, but we're not looking at how Trump got in there, which is going to lead us exactly where we're at right now. This is why I'm not voting for Joe Biden. Honestly, I feel that if we support a rapist or a racist who rigs elections, then I can't morally vote for Joe Biden either. So I think that it's time that we start doing a little bit more for maybe a third party or taking
well,
the streets.
Well, I appreciate the concept. And the notion of a third party in American politics has been around for a long, long time. In fact, we had a real left, a strong left in America in various times in the 1920s and in the 30s and so on. But the culture and the power is are such that we have to choose, we really have to choose among evils. And that is a sick thing to say, but it's true. If you allow Trump to have another 4 years, you are essentially building your own concentration camp.
Here's where we disagree. If I could just say, I think here's where we disagree. You're looking at ways through the system, which I know is a fixed system, and you're looking at as a broken system as being able to repair it. Now the difference is that it's like this. It's like the trolley thing, right? It's like you're at the train track thing. You can switch it and save five people, or you can push three people off. You know that silly thing, right?
Oh yeah. Sure.
I wouldn't do that. I'm not going to vote for a lesser of evil, especially in a state where the Electoral College is picking it with popular vote. But if I'm not going to vote for a lesser of evil, because that's still evil, and just because the Democrats are better at, you know,
that's fine, dude. You cast your vote and you feel serene and pristine in your moral purity. Meanwhile, the rest of us are going to try to get an incompetent fascist out of the White House. Now, I need to say something here, and I think it's very important to understanding this conversation. You cast a number of aspersions our way in the course of this phone call, most notably assuming that we think that Trump is the root of the problem. That tells me that maybe you're not familiar with this radio program, or you haven't been listening to it very long, or maybe you're just not listening to what we had to say. We have literally for years on this program been talking about the moral rot that's been making its way through the Republican Party, and we have talked explicitly many, many, many times about how Donald Trump is not the root of the problem here, but an outgrowth, a symptom of this deeper underlying disease. That is something that's been well established in the discourse of And I understand what you're saying about the frustration of rooting for the lesser of two evils. But here's something you need to understand about that sort of false equivalent that you're setting up. They are not the same. They may not be satisfactory, the Democratic Party, but for a long time now, they have been a considerably better option than the Republicans. And a lot of you people listening don't like to hear this, but it's true. It was untrue in 2000 when Ralph Nader was running for president, when people on the left said, oh, there's no difference between the Democrats and the Republicans. There's no difference between George W. Bush and Al Gore. Well, that was false on its face. And we went on to reap the harvest of electing George W. Bush. Now, am I saying to you that the Democratic alternatives in these many elections along the way are satisfactory from a leftist point of view, from a progressive point of view? No, they are absolutely not satisfactory. But the reality of our situation in American life and in American politics is that we have to fight a holding action against the corporate forces that are pushing us towards a right-wing totalitarianism. And I'm telling you right now that we have never been closer to that right-wing totalitarianism than we are right at this moment. So if it makes you feel better to sit above it all and not vote for the what you call the lesser of two evils, that's fine. But I don't want you to call up this program and complain if Trump is reelected and things go seriously to hell. Rant over.
Oh, I don't ever complain. Hey, no. And
let no, me- you don't ever complain.
I want to apologize, first of all. You are right. I listen to your program a lot. You are always pointing out that this has been a larger thing, but you do complain about Donald Trump in so many regards.
Yes.
I find it disgusting.
Yes, of course we complain about Donald Trump. He's a disaster.
Hold on. You're yelling. I'm trying to have a conversation, but I feel like it's a distraction from the larger point, like Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats approving everything that the war budget has been about, but not. And you brought it up earlier. We didn't impeach him. Why didn't the Democrats go after all the emoluments clauses that could have gotten actual impeachment? It's because this is planned. Now let me go back to Al Gore and George Bush. If we had a democracy, and you know what I mean, the Supreme Court was rigged there. What I'm trying to say is that this is a rigged thing. That's why Bernie Sanders gets rigged out. There is no when Obama was a president. And I used to protest with Black Lives Matter, the Dakota Access Pipeline, and Occupy Wall Street. I was telling people back then that America is a fascist state, that America is Nazi Germany 1938. And people would be like, shut up, Robbie. How dare you say that? We have a black person as a president. Donald Trump's in office, I say it, and people believe me now. So what I'm getting at, what I'm trying to communicate is that there is this matrix of a world that we are living in under this false premises that we have democracy when we don't. And right now, we're falling victim to the lesser of two evils, which got us to the fascist state that you're complaining about. And if we don't observe it like that, and we just get in Joe Biden, this is playing the game's rules. And I'm against that. Well, I've been doing things that I can to actually do change, which is what I don't see happening with Joe Biden getting in office. Maybe.
Okay, fair enough.
I don't know.
All right, we're gonna leave it there because we need to get some others a chance to call. Robbie, your calls are always smart. They're always provocative. And I'm sorry I got mad at you, man.
No, I think the argument has a great deal of legitimacy, but this is where we are. This is the country we live in. This is the situation in the world that we're in. The environment is being destroyed. Capitalism has proven itself to be very evil and very strong in our society. The question really is, what pragmatically can be accomplished within this construct? And I could say, ideologically, we need a system that is much more, in fact, purely socialist. We need a system where every man and woman and child, regardless of their race and their creed and so forth and so on, has a true chance at a decent life. We all probably would agree about that. The problem is that ain't the world we're living in. And we are right now living in a situation which I see as very much a parallel, interestingly enough, to what happened in the 30s in Germany. It's dangerous. It's very, very dangerous. And the victims here will be lefties and persons of color, and it is not a situation of luxury. We are pushed into a pragmatic situation, and I really believe that we cannot allow this fascist government to continue because it's going to hurt everybody and it's going to be very dangerous. And I'll make a prediction right now. if Trump gets frightened enough and he's acting pretty scared and he is a crazy person, we may find ourselves in a war with someplace like China for no real reason. And I just am terrified of that, and I think it's a valid fear.
All right, let's go back to the phones. Jeremy, you're next.
Yeah, well, Robbie's reading of history is a bit off, because in 1938 in Germany, I mean, during the Obama administration, I wouldn't be alive, and I don't think Joe would either, since we're both Jewish, right?
Yeah.
We would have been in a camp. So, you know, I've been criticizing people for calling the U.S. fascist for a long time, until very recently. We're not quite there yet, but it's no longer inappropriate to use, as I call it, the real F word. So, I mean, that's like outer space. The polling is so powerful that I'm fairly sure I can avoid voting, you know, that I'll vote for Jill Stein or something, but I'll see it. Like, I'm willing to consider voting for Biden, who is so horrific I can't think straight. However, as you presented your fears about, I don't think we're close to 1933, but if he's talking like, well, maybe we're going to go there if they haven't managed to steal enough votes. Anyway, I want to quote Eugene Debs, who was, by the way, quite racist, but he was a great labor leader and a bit of a racist, and he overcame his racism enough to allow black people into the railroad union. Anyway, it is better to vote for something you want and not get it than to vote for something you don't want and to get it. And since I don't particularly want Jill Stein, maybe I'll just vote for Biden based on that.
You know, that was the argument. That was the argument of Eugene Debs in 1920, actually.
I just quoted Debs.
And let me say something.
Yeah. He was invoking Debs.
In a pure sense, you have a very valid point. In reality, this is what it is, and we have to deal with it as it is, and we cannot fantasize some other
situation. No, I agree. I mean, what Chomsky's been saying to Amy Goodman periodically when she brings it up is, you know, of course vote, but realize that the real work is elsewhere.
Yeah, absolutely. I can agree with that. There's much work to be done, and much of it is outside the polling world.
Pretty much all of it.
For example, let me make a very important point, I think. There is part of the Trump effort to destroy the Postal Service in the United States.
No kidding.
Now, I'm not bringing that up to be a non sequitur. It is part of a really, I think, ingenious
connected
plan
to the election
to destroy the public opportunity to have a vote, which is necessary to be on in the mails because of the virus, which exists in the form it exists in this country because of the fascist king.
Yeah, no argument there. And something I kind of missed, and in case other people missed it too, yeah, I'll share it, which is that the other places that the orange Nazi has been sending, you know, the Einsatzgruppen, you know, his federal attack force, have been swing states. You know, Cleveland, Michigan, Wisconsin. He's talking about all these cities need my help. I guess Illinois too. Is it all like Illinois is a swing state too, of course. So, you know, it's got nothing to do with, you know, their horrific murder rate. It's got a whole lot to do with November.
Yeah, you're absolutely correct.
I think he's going to make another
right about that.
For Portland. I think, you know, they have not quite given up on the idea of Little Beirut, and they're hoping to, you know, it didn't quite work, although I don't know. I mean, I'm talking to friends from all over the country, and they say, I watched was Fox News, I would consider Portland to be on fire. You know, CNN gets it halfway that it's, you know, three or four blocks, and that it's not on fire.
Listen, I don't disagree totally with what you're saying, but there really is a fundamental, I think there's a fundamental difference. It is not inappropriate in this situation to get rid of the fascist king. On the other hand, that's not enough. We all need to work much harder to create racial justice, to create a system that is not so dominatingly capitalist, and ideally to create a society which is a social democracy, which we do not have having said that, I think we need to move on.
Yeah, thank you for the call. Appreciate it. David is up next. Good morning.
Oh, morning. Yeah, there are so many different things that are going on at once. I've lived through any number of different election years where, you know, you've got two bad choices and no time to choose. And that's
that's certainly true often.
Yeah, and it's horrible. And actually, this current situation where everybody's broke, they've still got their wits about them, but, you know, we haven't had so many people die that our spirits are broken, that we actually have a lot of opportunities at this point. Say, for example, one of the previous callers was talking about global warming and, you know, whether or not either side is going to do anything about it. You know, I've personally been calling up, you know, gardening shows on Saturday and just urging people to get started planting trees. You know, we're out of work right now. We've got plenty of time on our hand. You've got the opportunity to get out in the woods or, you know, do, you know, social distancing from out in the woods. Get out there and gather seeds, you know, to... If global warming's solution has to do with planting more trees, there's plenty of opportunity to get out there and take part in all of that.
That's certainly a good thing to do, and it's certainly appropriate. But I don't think it's an adequate response to the situation. I think we really have to take the back of monopoly capitalism, but we have to do it recognizing where we are now.
Well, I don't disagree. And that's what I'm saying. Right now, everybody's broke. You know, I'm baby boom, right? And when you start looking at monopoly capitalism, it's basically a series of tricks, you know, sleights of hand with the numbers. And as a baby boomer, I can remember 1968 when the baby boom was hitting the work market, and it took 20 hours at minimum wage to buy 1 ounce of gold. Now, you know, it was $1.60 and an ounce of gold was $32. If you take the ounce of gold today, it's over now $2,000. Divide that by 20 and you're going to get a $100 minimum wage. $100 minimum wage and in order to do 20 hours to buy an ounce of gold. But if you do it by the, I think it was better than 250 hours at the current minimum wage. That shows you the reality that instead of taking 20 hours to buy an ounce of gold, it takes you 250 hours to buy an ounce of gold. So their numbers are entirely fraudulent. And in fact, Trump, you know, is trying to make a new Fed appointment that's a woman that believes in the gold standard. So is she going to raise the minimum wage to $100 an hour? Of course not. And so, you know, they're playing games with our... And it's, you know, there's an old quatrain from Omar Khayyam that talks about the gods looking down at the people and playing them like they're a chess game. And, you know, getting them killed, of course. And so the whole idea that we just go ahead and ignore them, you know, ignore their money system, get back to the things that matter, get to the, you know, the economy of the laws of physics, the economy of the laws of nature, and totally ignore their economy of sweatshops. And in fact, this whole thing raises the issue, if this disease did start in Wuhan, China, and you look at Wuhan, China as being an extremely polluted city, and that all of the bugs that are flying around Wuhan that are eaten by bats are polluted bugs, and that those bats have then converted them to some sort of an awful disease, and that the sweatshop workers that can't afford to buy real food have to eat bats.
You're engaging in some big speculation here about the origins of the coronavirus.
The other option.
Yeah, I have to say, I think that one of the things that's going on with the Trump people, and I don't think you intend this, but it's really true, is to demonize China and demonize the virus notice how Trump always talks about it being the Chinese virus.
Well, if that's not
pretty,
what I'm trying
that's
to
pretty,
do.
At this point, let me finish. That's pretty much irrelevant. This is something that has been, it could have been a different disease, but this is a thing that happens periodically, and it could have happened at any one of many points. The biggest problem about it in our society is that we do not have a decent healthcare system that takes care of the people. And that is because we have a capitalist healthcare system.
We do not. But the point I was trying to make was that pollution and putting all your eggs in one basket, which is a big aspect of capitalism, that I'm going by the assumption that China is no longer communist. If they're sweatshop, you know, they're like a sweatshop country, there's no workers of the world unite in that. So they are just as much a corporate state system as Russia is with their oligarchs. They, you know, and the United States is. So it's three different versions of the corporate state, which is exactly what Mussolini and Hitler were working on, the corporate state. So we the people, since the numbers are never going to match up with a $100 an hour minimum wage or that the rainforests have to be chopped up into cardboard for Amazon to do shipping packages, you know, this is the economy is a total farce all the way around. So we might as well just junk the economy and get back to the things that matter. And
we're going to leave it there. We are going to leave it there.
I think we should leave it there. But there's one thing I want to say. We can talk about what ought to be or what should be or what could be. All of us engage in that. But where we are is where we are. And what we can do realistically within the situation of where we are is very limited. And we must act now to stop this fascist crazy person from... You watch what's going to happen. You watch how he will deny his losing the election when he loses it. He's already working on making it hard for people to vote by mail, knowing that the virus makes it dangerous to vote in person. And you've got to understand the degree to which this cuckoo guy has been allowed, for various reasons, to become the president of the United States. It's beyond the left and the right. It's fascist, and it's very, very dangerous.
Okay,
leave it at that.
All right, let's go to Cassandra before the end here.
Cassandra? Oh, Cassandra, I like Cassandra.
Redeem us, okay. Please, Cassandra.
Hi, guys. I'm listening to this, and I think any sane person can agree we need to get rid of the pumpkin. Okay. I think you guys need the perspective of a mother. And here's the perspective of this mother. You have an option. You're in the desert. You've got water enough to drink or wash your hands because you're now possibly infected with corona. What are you going to do? Well, you can't survive to deal with corona unless you drink the water first to not die of, you know, thirst. So we need to get rid of the first problem before we can tackle the second problem. It's simple, pragmatic solution. Get rid of Trump. Then on the day we get Biden in, we can all go out and protest and say, we're not going to put up with your BS. So we got to get him out first. Then we can deal with the real crap of our society second. You know, ideals are wonderful. I'm a very idealistic person too. But you do have to deal with the pragmatic issues of the moment before you can deal with the real issues of the future. That's a mother.
Well,
brush your teeth.
You know, I have never wanted to fight with mother. And I also think that what you're saying is logical. It is a recognition of the facts of time and space and the dangers we're in. And I appreciate the comments. I really do.
Yeah. I just feel that we are in this for a long haul. People have to recognize that. This is not a sprinter's race. This is a long-distance race. We have a multitude of issues to deal with. Every single one of them deserve our attention. But you have to deal with things and prioritize things in order to get to more things. Because if we don't, then everything else is going to be a moot point. and we need to be aware that there is not going to be a hallelujah day. There are going to be hallelujah moments, and then you keep going.
Yeah.
Anyway, yeah, that's all
right.
I have to say.
You're right. Well, thank you very much for that much-needed reality check here at the close of our program. She's right.
Oh, you guys
she's
are great. Right. I'm just saying that people, yeah. We all have our what we want to achieve, but we do have to keep our eye on the prize, and the prize is a long time coming.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Hey, thanks for the call.
Thanks.
Yeah, she's right. She's right. There's a lot of work ahead of us. A lot of work ahead of us before this virus is behind us, and a whole lot more work than that before we start looking like something approaching a really just society. So, yeah, I think that does it for this edition of the Abe and Joe Show.
Yeah, I think we've covered a lot of ground very quickly and probably ignored a lot of things we shouldn't have ignored. But the fact of the matter is the primary issue of the moment is to get rid of the fascist pig, because the fascist pig is eating our entrails.
Yeah, coupled with the other primary issue of the moment, which is stay home and don't be a disease transmission vector.
And wear a mask. It's good to wear a mask. You know, there were riots against masks in the pandemic of 1918.
Yeah, yeah, I read about that over the weekend. Yeah, the more things change, right?
Hey, yeah.
All right, this has been the Abe and Joe Talk Radio program on 90.7 KBOO. You can become a member, make a contribution by going to KBOO.fm, clicking on the donate button. We need your support now more than ever. Thanks for tuning in.
You're tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the